to let me know. Should I stay or should I go? If you say that you are mine, I'll be here till the end of time. So you got to let me.
Welcome to the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Meet 'em, greet 'em, treat 'em, and street 'em. Today's date is Friday, December 13th, 2013, and I am your skeptical host, Ken Milne. The title of today's podcast is Should I Stay or Should I Go Now? Biphasic Anaphylactic Responses. And our special guest skeptic on today's podcast is Dr. Anand Swaminathan, or Swami to his friends. He is an assistant program director at New York University Bellevue Hospital in the Department of Emergency Medicine. And Swami's interests are in resident education, critical care, and one of my favorite, evidence-based medicine. Swami apparently loves debunking urban legends. Now, I'm not talking about urban legends like, you know, alligators in the New York sewer. More like it's safe to use epinephrine-containing lidocaine for digital blocks. Swami is also a strong supporter of FOAM, or free open access to medication. And I want to give you a big skeptical welcome to the SGEM. Swami, welcome.
Thanks, Ken. It's great to be here. I just got turned on to your podcast recently, but I love it, and I've shared it with many of my residents here at Bellevue.
Well, thank you very much. Are you feeling extra skeptical today?
I'm feeling extra skeptical. Absolutely.
Super. So then you're on the right program. Let's dive right in, and I'm going to give you a case scenario to go through in dealing with biphasic anaphylactic responses. So the case scenario, given the time of year, is that you have a 25-year-old medical student who's allergic to peanuts, and he accidentally eats a cookie at the school holiday party. He arrives to the ED where you're working, and he is covered in hives, short of breath, and hypotensive. He's also vomiting. Now, the ED resident who you're working with diagnoses him quickly with anaphylaxis and does a great job in treating the reaction. The patient is now stable, and you're considering, as the attending, discharging him home. However, you ask your resident, hey, what about a biphasic anaphylactic response? Smart, Swami. So the question today is, how long should you observe someone after anaphylaxis? Whoa, but before we get too into this, we better start with some definitions here. So Swami, can you define anaphylaxis so we're all starting on the same page?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, anaphylaxis is sort of exists on this spectrum, going from a mild allergic reaction all the way up to anaphylaxis. And I think for years we've had a difficult time quantifying it. It's one of those, I don't know exactly how to tell you what it is, but I know what it is when I see it. Now, there are some definitions there, and mainly what they're looking at is multiple systems involved. So when you look at it, what they often quote is you should have skin involvement. You should have maybe GI involvement, so nausea or vomiting, respiratory compromise, which many of the guidelines don't go into exactly what that means, but I take that to mean either upper or lower airway respiratory compromise. And then hypotension is the last one. Now, you can have hypotension alone, and that qualifies as anaphylaxis. So you've been exposed to an allergen, patient comes in with a systolic under 90, that's enough to be called anaphylaxis.
Sorry, Swami, you don't have to have a rash then or a skin involvement? You can just come in hypotensive after a known allergen?
Yeah, that's one of the tough presentations is when they don't have the rash. And about 10% of patients won't come in with a rash. They'll come in with other symptoms, maybe hypotension and vomiting or respiratory compromise and hypotension. And I think those are the ones that we have a little bit more difficulty teasing out and figuring out that it is anaphylaxis. And some of that comes from the history of being exposed to some kind of an allergen leading to that. So with the exception of hypotension, Ken, you really need two of these symptoms in combination. Although I'll tell you that if somebody comes in after being exposed to an allergen and they've got any kind of respiratory compromise, I'm going to call that anaphylaxis, because what I want to make sure that everyone's aware of is that I'm worried about this patient and where they're going.
So why do you think this definition is so important? I mean, are we missing this, or are we underdiagnosing anaphylaxis?
Well, that's what a lot of the literature says. So if you look at the guidelines, and again, when we talk about literature here, we're not talking about randomized control trials. That's probably never going to happen for anaphylaxis because it's a life-threatening problem, just like any other critical care issue. So the literature we have is a lot of expert guidelines. The most recent one that I've seen was from Current Opinions in Allergy and Clinical Immunology. It's one of my favorite journals. I read it often and frequently. But this one in 2012, they looked at this and what they said is, you know, we're missing anaphylaxis a lot. We're underdiagnosing it and we're undertreating it. And so we're not sending home people with epinephrine and we're not giving epinephrine in the emergency department. So they really wanted to focus on looking for two systems involved, and that's enough to call it anaphylaxis and pull the trigger on your first line treatments.
Yeah, the one I think that I probably miss the most would be the GI symptoms. You know, if somebody comes in vomiting and I'm not really, you know, thinking right up front, could this be an allergic reaction?
I totally agree. A lot of these are food exposures as well, so it's a little hard to know, did they eat something and get a little bit of a gastroenteritis picture, or is this nausea and vomiting part of an anaphylactic syndrome?
Well, Swami, you mentioned treatment, so let's just jump into some treatment so everybody knows that how this resident successfully treated this person that they diagnosed with anaphylaxis. What's your go-to grab bag? What's in your toolbox when it comes to anaphylaxis?
Yeah, Ken. So I think the number one thing that we should be doing is giving epinephrine. We talked about this a little bit, but epinephrine really is the first line treatment for anaphylaxis. It's probably the only thing that we know is going to work. And when I say we know, again, we don't have randomized control trials, but we see this happen in front of us. Somebody comes in with respiratory compromise, maybe wheezing, maybe their lips are swollen or their tongue is swollen. You give them epinephrine, they get better very quickly. So how do we give the epinephrine? And this is one of the keys. It should be 0.3 to 0.5 milligrams of the 1 to 1,000 concentration, and we should be giving it intramuscularly. Most of the time we're giving this in the arm because it's the easiest point to access, but the thigh is fine as well. And I think the route is really important here. IM is better than subcutaneous. Subcutaneous takes a little bit more blood flow. And remember, these patients are hypotensive. Blood is being shunted away from the skin. So sub-Q is going to take a little bit longer to absorb into the system. We're not talking about intravenous epinephrine. When we talk about the dangers associated with epinephrine, and people get a little bit sort of anxious about using epinephrine sometimes, I think, which is probably why we don't do it as much as we should. The harms of epinephrine really have been seen when the wrong dose is given by the wrong route. So if you give this amount of epinephrine, 0.3 to 0.5 of the 1 to 1,000 intravenously, that's a huge dose. You don't give 300 to 500 mics of epi as an IV push to a living person. Not a good idea.
And I don't think that there's any contraindications if somebody presents with anaphylaxis to getting epinephrine.
That's right. There's no real contraindications here. If they're actively having an MI in front of you while they're anaphylactic, they should probably still get epinephrine. Because remember, the anaphylactic reaction is serious and immediately life-threatening. And if we can reverse that process, we're going to reverse a lot of other things that are going wrong for this patient. And again, we don't have great studies on this. The best I could really find was from the Annals of Emergency Medicine in the late 80s from Rita Sadulka, looking at epinephrine administration across age groups. They had people as old as in the early 90s, didn't really find any problems with giving the drug. But again, these aren't large randomized control trials. It's just the best that we have.
So epi. There, I've said it three times. Epi. Let's move on to the next thing in your treatment toolbox.
Yeah, so when we're talking about true anaphylaxis, epinephrine is sort of the beginning and kind of the end. We don't really have much evidence to use anything else. Now, there are a lot of other drugs that I've used. I've used some inhaled beta agonists like albuterol. I'm not sure how much of a role that has, even if they're wheezing, because you are giving them IM epinephrine, but it's reasonable to throw it on. Some people have talked about using inhaled epinephrine, so sort of the same thing that you would do in a bronchiolitis patient or a croup patient, although I think there's some the evidence behind using it in those cases is also a little bit sketchy. But, you know, maybe if they've got some upper airway swelling, a little bit of inhaled epinephrine is going to help. Again, not much evidence, but what I do is I give them that inhaled epinephrine along with some inhaled lidocaine because I want to numb their airway. The reason I want to numb the airway is I'm kind of thinking ahead of myself that we may have to intubate this patient. If we're going to intubate them, I'd like the airway topicalized because maybe I'll do an awake intubation. So I'm okay with giving inhaled epinephrine. I'm not sure how much it works, though, to be totally honest with you. And then we sort of get to our other drugs that we typically use in allergic reactions, and we're going to give to this patient as well, things like Benadryl, diphenhydramine, and H2 blockers like ranitidine or famotidine. We don't think these things are going to work immediately for these patients, but we still do it. And then the last one is probably the corticosteroid. And I say last because we know it's not going to work right away. This is going to take 4 to 6 hours before it has any action. And Ken, you know, when we look at how these things work and how anaphylaxis works, basically you get an allergen that comes in and your mast cells degranulate and they release all of the histamine they've stored up into your body, causing this huge reaction.
They just take a histamine dump. That's what I describe it to the residents as. They just take this big dump of histamine into your circulation.
That's exactly what it is. It is the mast cells are having their morning constitutional in your bloodstream. And it's just histamine everywhere. And so, you know, steroids, what steroids are supposed to do is they're supposed to stabilize mast cells. That's sort of like closing the barn door after the horse has already left. You know, we can't do that. There's no point to doing that. And the H1 and the H2 blockers, they probably are going to just get overwhelmed. I think there's so much histamine in the body that they're not going to really be able to block those histamine receptors as well as they normally would. The epinephrine, on the other hand, is going to reverse the hypotension. It's going to reverse the airway swelling, and it's going to give the body time to either break the histamine down or some of that is going to get reuptake into the mast cells.
Okay, well, that's a good review of anaphylaxis treatment, and that's something we should all be doing well, hopefully, if we're in emergency medicine. But the topic today is on biphasic anaphylactic reactions. And so let's get to talk about that. You know, I mean, this is the dreaded fear that they may leave the department and have this biphasic reaction. So can you give us a definition of biphasic reaction and maybe how often or how common is it?
Yeah, absolutely, Ken. So this is, again, the topic at hand, biphasic anaphylactic reactions. So we've seen this, or we've at least heard about it and been taught about it, that patients will get better in front of us, we'll discharge them, and then there's a small risk of them having a repeat anaphylaxis sometime after treatment. So the key here is their symptoms resolved and then have gotten worse again. Now, what that time period is a little bit tough. You can have immediate biphasic reaction, which means while you're still in the emergency room, you have a repeat anaphylactic reaction, and then you can have a delayed one. And the delayed response can be anywhere from, again, that 10 minutes up until 6 or 7 days. So when you look at the literature, there are case reports describing patients who were not re-exposed to an allergen, but had a repeat or a biphasic anaphylactic reaction up to 6 or 7 days after their initial presentation. And this is what sort of scares us, because we have a patient who is sick. We give them epinephrine. They feel better. We discharge them after some observation period.
Yeah, we start doing the high fives with everybody. Woohoo! We saved one, right? And then send them
absolutely
out the door.
And then we send them home, and then they're going to re-anaphylax and die, and we're going to sort of be on the hook for not having done something else for them. And that, you know, I think the only something else that we do, the main things we do are we send them home with corticosteroids, thinking maybe that's going to reduce the chance of a biphasic anaphylactic reaction, although there's no real evidence to back that up. And we give them EpiPens, and we teach them how to use the EpiPen. And I think that's the critical thing that we can do for these patients is give them an EpiPen. And actually, what I do is I give them at least three, one for their purse, one for the home, and one for their car. And if it's a guy, you know, most of the guys in New York also carry purses, so no problem there. But the EpiPen and teaching them how to use one and empowering them to use it when they get a reaction is probably the thing that's going to save their lives if either they have a re-exposure to the allergen or if they get a biphasic response. So either way, this biphasic response is what scares us. It's what makes us watch patients, what makes us give them these medications. And how frequent is it? That's a tough thing to sort of quantify. The best literature review that I found was in 2007 in the Clinics of North America Immunology and Allergy. And they said you could have biphasic reactions in between 3% and 20% of patients.
That's a scary number. Up to one out of every five patients you send home is going to anaphylact again?
That's a really scary number. And when I read it, it was a little bit hard for me to believe. And the reason it was hard for me to believe is, you know, I work in a couple of different hospitals, but one of them is a big city hospital, county hospital, where the patients often can't go anywhere else. When I say can't, it's because they can't afford to go to another hospital to get treatment. They live in the area, that's where they come. And I haven't seen very many of these patients that I treat for anaphylaxis coming back to my hospital. And granted, they could have gone somewhere else, but it seems unlikely that I would have missed all of them going to another hospital. So I haven't seen 20%, one in five of them coming back. So when I looked at the data a little bit closer, what I found was, first of all, a lot of these are case series. They're not really robust data sets. But more importantly than that, is that they called a biphasic reaction any repeat allergic reaction. So if the person had an anaphylactic reaction first and then came back in because they got hives 3 days later, they called that a biphasic response. But Ken, you and I don't really care about that. We don't really care if the patient gets a rash again. What we want is we care about the significant allergic responses, the significant anaphylactic responses, the ones that require treatment in the emergency room is what we actually care about. And I think that's why that number is so inflated, 3 to 20%.
I agree. I've not observed in my clinical experience, and those are dangerous things to say because of all the biases involved, but I have certainly not observed in our small rural community where people would have to drive to another community to get to another hospital. One out of every five are bouncing back with significant clinically important anaphylactic reactions.
Absolutely. And you know what? They go on to say that some of the authors in these studies recommend a 24-hour observation period for anybody who comes in with an anaphylactic reaction. Although they go on to say that an extended observation would be justified in patients with severe or protracted anaphylaxis, the added cost and resource use involved in routine prolonged monitoring of patients whose symptoms have resolved may worsen ED crowding while likely adding little to individual patient safety. And I think this dichotomous or dual responses that maybe we should watch them for 24 hours, but that's going to lead to a lot of crowding that might not be useful, is what gives us emergency physicians who practice a little bit of angst about how long I should be watching these patients. If it's really 20%, should we watch them for a day? Should we watch them for a week? I don't really know, but I don't think it's that high. I think the serious responses are considerably lower. And I think that's what our study that we're going to look at is going to tell us about.
And that exactly brings us back to the question of today's podcast, and that's how long should we really observe someone after anaphylaxis? And we're looking for some high quality evidence, and a new study just came out in 2003 that addressed this biphasic reaction. So you picked this study. Do you want to introduce it and I'll give the author's conclusions?
Yeah, absolutely. So the study was in Annals of Emergency Medicine in this year. It's a EPUB ahead of print. So if you're just getting the hard copy at home, you're not going to have seen this one yet.
We are cutting the KT window from 10 years down to 1 year.
Yeah, this one is almost seeing into the future, Ken, because nobody's gotten this one in at home. You've got to be looking at the Annals website to find this one.
Or so listening to the podcast.
Or listening to this podcast. So the article here is Incidence of Clinically Important Biphasic Reactions in Emergency Department Patients with Allergic Reactions or Anaphylaxis.
I want to point out that this is a Canadian study, by the way. The author's conclusions were, quote, among ED patients with allergic reactions or anaphylaxis, clinically important biphasic reactions and fatalities are rare. Our data suggests that prolonged routine monitoring of patients whose symptoms have resolved is likely unnecessary for patient safety. Ooh, I like the conclusions already. But let's go through the actual paper and break it down from an EBM critical review standpoint and see if their conclusions are really supported by their data. And, we always sort of start with a PICO. That's the population intervention control and outcome. And the population that they were looking at was adults, so greater than 17 years of age, at two urban emergency departments in British Columbia, Canada, with allergic reactions or anaphylaxis. And their intervention, well, it was a retrospective chart review, and so there was really no controls with it, but their primary outcome was a biphasic reaction. So if they were represented to the emergency department with a biphasic reaction, and the secondary outcome was mortality. Now, when you look at studies, it's always important to look at the exclusion criteria. Who did they exclude? So can you apply it to your population? And so this did not involve children. So don't apply the conclusions from this study to children when you're looking at them. The primary diagnosis was asthma or an allergy that was secondary. These patients were not included. And patients who left the ED prior to treatment, so they left without being seen, were not captured in the study. And if a patient had a pre-existing condition of angioedema. So that takes us through the PICO and the excluded criteria. And we have the results. Now, did you take a look at the results there, Swami, that I sent you?
Yeah, absolutely. You want me to go through those for you?
Yeah, why don't we go back and forth through those? I mean, they had over 400,000 visits to these two emergency departments over a 5-year period. But how many charts did they end up reviewing out of that 400,000?
So they found about 2,800 that were reviewed for this study.
So, and those were people that were defined as either allergic reaction uncoating, so they were coded as an allergic reaction, or they were coded as an anaphylactic reaction. And that total was just about 0.7%. And when you broke down that 2,800, 18% were classified as anaphylactic, about 500 patients, and about 2,300 were considered allergic reactions. How many people did they actually bounce back after they discharged those 2,800 people with allergic reactions?
So about 6.5% of patients bounced back for something related to their allergic reactions. 185 of those 2,800 patients bounced back.
So maybe,
within 7 days.
Yeah, and so within a week, you got about a 6% bounce back rate. Is that right?
That's right.
And so 6% would be, you know, in reason with that 3 to 20% of patients coming back, but not necessarily clinically important biphasic
Absolutely.
Reactions. So how many of those clinically important, the ones that we're worried about, oh my God, they're going to come back and die and I'm going to be responsible. How many actually out of those 2,800 bounced back to the emerge with
so
a biphasic?
So that number was much lower, five. Five patients, not 5%, but five patients bounced back with clinically significant. That's 0.18% of that 2,800 that bounced back within 7 days with a biphasic allergic reaction. But the caveat on that is it wasn't actually five that bounced back. It was actually three that bounced back because two patients had immediate biphasic reactions while they were in the emergency department. So these patients had reactions 10, 15 minutes after they got better. They had a second reaction. So only three patients actually were discharged and then came back with a biphasic response that was clinically significant.
So that's 0.1%. 0.1%. I mean, that is a really small number.
Yeah, absolutely. Much smaller than I thought it would be, for sure.
And I think that sort of validates some of our own, let's say, gut feelings about how many people that we're seeing that we're worried about bouncing back. How many fatalities were there, though?
Zero. Absolutely none.
My favorite number when it comes to fatalities. I do have a few favorite numbers, five being my most common favorite number and 11, but I really like zero when it comes to fatalities.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, Ken, I was going to say when we let off that this podcast really is going to go to 11, but you're right. When it comes to fatalities, we want that number to be a single round numeral, and zero is a good one to have for it.
So let's put our skeptical critical review hat on here and look at this from a EBM perspective. It was a chart review, a retrospective chart review. And so we're always concerned about the quality of retrospective chart reviews. But you know what? These guys did a really good job. In a previous podcast, we discussed the criteria for good chart reviews, and those were following the Gilbert et al. And the Worster et al. Criteria. And the Worster et al. Criteria built on Gilbert and came up with 12 criteria. And you know what? They were 11 out of 12 when it came to these criteria. I'll put them up in the blog, but you know, if you're interested in doing research and you're thinking a good way to get started would be to do a chart review, make sure you get this Worster paper because it lays out exactly how you can do a high quality chart review. And they did get 11 out of the 12 Worster criteria. Now, Andrew Worster, of course, is my EBM guru, my mentor, or maybe what you would consider, Swami, your Newman.
Absolutely. You know, Dave Newman is my go-to guy for any kind of EBM questions or stats questions. So always nice to have a Newman or in this case a Worster in your back pocket.
So I've got a Worster and he always told me it all depends. And you know what? It depends on how we looked at these 12 criteria. And the one that they didn't satisfy was the abstractors were not blinded to the outcome or what the study was all about. But in the end, I don't think that blinding made much difference because they were inputting the variables before that. So the input, the variables on the chart were done before they abstracted them. So even though they were abstracting the variables out of it and were not blinded to what they were researching, the people putting in the variables were blinded. So I don't think that really affected their outcome in any way. So
yeah, I agree. And, you know, as we're getting into the methods of this, a couple of things that I thought were pretty important that they did here is, you know, one, in their system, you could only code these things as allergic reaction. So they weren't worried about missing patients who were coded as anaphylactic shock or something like that, that would have missed some of those patients. And then after they got all those allergic reactions, they had to go back and decide whether it was an anaphylactic response or sort of a run-of-the-mill allergic reaction. And they actually then took a 10% of those charts and looked for inter-rater reliability. And they ranked very high on inter-rater reliability in this. So those are some good things as well when we're talking about chart reviews.
But there are some limitations that we still need to talk about with this paper.
Absolutely. So I think there were a couple. You know, we talked about this being a retrospective chart review. What we would have liked is a prospective analysis looking at these patients. But what we got was a retrospective, but it was done pretty well. The problem here, you know, a couple of them, 104 of the allergic reactions were missing data, so not all of their vital signs were there. We talked about the blinding issue already. There was really no defined protocol, at least that they shared in the paper, of how patients with allergic reactions were treated. So I think that's important to know as well. The patients may have been missed. So the repeat reactions, the biphasic responses, it was possible they were missed. So what they did was they looked at the two institutions that they worked in that they initially took their charts from for any bounce back visits. And they also looked at a registry data from the area, looking at whether the patients came to any of the other hospitals. Now, Ken, I'll tell you that this is a study that could never really be done here in the U.S. because we can't really do these registry type things. You know, our system is so not integrated that I could never track these patients if they went to another hospital. So they were able to do that with this registry. Now, it's possible that a patient left the area and went to a hospital outside of that registry or went to a primary care doctor to be treated for their biphasic response. Those are possible, but they said, you know, it's pretty unlikely. First of all, because we've got a huge catchment area, which this registry. On top of that, it seems that if somebody had a significant biphasic response, they probably wouldn't have been cared for just by a primary care doctor. And I would go on to say that if they were cared for by a primary care doctor, it probably wasn't that significant of a biphasic response. And then again, we mentioned this before, coding issues. It's still possible that patients were miscoded. You know, they put down as shock, as a sort of general term of shock, as opposed to allergic reaction. Or maybe they were given the diagnosis of a nonspecific rash instead of it being anaphylaxis or allergic reaction. Those things are also possible and not much of a way for us to figure that out.
And just to back up, so people understand, when you say going outside of the area, when we're talking about going outside of the area, the healthcare system in Canada is set up as a provincial system or a state. So everyone in that state or province has access to healthcare. I know that's a strange concept to you, but everybody had it. So to go outside of their catchment or whatever means leaving the province. They would have to have presented in a neighboring province or some other country not to have been captured. Out of that 400,000 plus patients that presented over 5 years, 20 patients didn't have a valid health care. Only 20 out of 400,000. They still received health care, of course, I'm sure, but only 20. So, I mean, I think those numbers are really, really small with regards to who they may have missed.
Absolutely. And again, it really speaks to the fact that this is an example of a study I could never do because we wouldn't be talking about 20 out of 400,000. We'd be talking about 20% or 30% out of 400,000 that didn't have any way for us to really track them.
Yeah. So what does this do for you, Swami? How does this study on biphasic reactions change your practice?
It's reassuring, Ken. You know, I've already been pretty aggressive about my discharge with these patients. I was taught by a lot of really, really good, strong emergency doctors who have a good grounding in emergency medicine. But when it came to anaphylaxis, I can think of one of my attendings who was wonderful, who simply said, I've never seen one. So as soon as they get better, they can go home. And if they don't have any kind of airway compromise or hypotension, he would basically give them a Benadryl in hand and whisk them out the door. So I've already been pretty aggressive about how long I've been watching people. I really haven't watched people for 4 to 6 hours. I watch them for a couple of hours. If they don't have any repeat symptoms, they go home with EpiPens, with steroids, and follow-up. So it didn't really change much for me, except again, to make me feel pretty good about what we were already doing. And again, I think one of the keys here is that that biphasic response can happen pretty far out of their initial treatment. You know, in this study, we were talking about things occurring up to 6 days after their initial response. I can't watch anyone for 6 days, Ken, so why watch them for 6 hours?
I agree. And, you know, when they looked at who had the biphasic reactions, those three patients that they drilled down, you know, because they had two that had biphasic reactions in the department and three that had it within the 7 days, one occurred at 28 hours. So that means you're going to miss two if you only hold them for a day. The second person had it at 35 hours. So now you're holding everybody for 48 hours. And then the last person had theirs at 143 hours. So to capture all of them, you'd have to hold everyone for 143 hours.
Yeah, and that's a tough thing for me to sell my hospital on, a 7-day admission for an allergic reaction.
That may or may not happen as a biphasic reaction.
Absolutely.
Or 0.1%, I think, was the number. So you're treating your allergic reaction then. If they come in with a rash, you're giving them...
Yeah, so if they come in with just a rash, I'm giving them an H1 and an H2 blocker, and then I'm going to watch them. If the rash isn't really bad, that's about all they're going to get, and they're going to go home with the same medications to take as an outpatient. I usually do give them a referral for follow-up with an allergist unless I can really pinpoint what that allergen was that set it off. You know, we've talked a lot about, when I say we, in my shop, we've talked a lot about steroids and whether we should be giving steroids to everyone with an allergic reaction. And I don't think that's really indicated. I think they've got to have more than just a little bit of a rash for me to give them a couple days of steroids. If I decide to give them steroids, though, I'll give them a dose in the department and I'll send them with another 4 days of about 1 mg/kg up to 50 milligrams of prednisone for them to take while they're as an outpatient and hope that that's going to reduce some of the symptoms. But I don't have much faith that it actually will. I think that diphenhydramine will reduce the itching, so it's going to make the symptoms a little bit more tolerable for the patient. And with the Zantac or the ranitidine, I think the benefit here is about 10% of the skin histamine receptors are actually H2 receptors instead of H1. So they have a rash. I think ranitidine or another H2 blocker can help those patients, and they're not really sedating either. So they can take them during the day, and maybe that'll help a little bit with the itching.
So for all those future researchers out there or some keen resident, if you're listening to this, how about doing a research project on this? I mean, we know about the H2 blockers. We've got some okay evidence, and I'm going to throw up some Cochrane reviews for those interested in doing some more reading. We don't have great evidence on the H2 blockers, but it's reasonable. But when you look at the H1 blockers like ranitidine, I mean, we really don't have great evidence at all of their effectiveness. And it seems like something that maybe somebody would be like resident stage could do a placebo controlled trial where everybody gets ranitidine or a placebo and assess their outcome.
Yeah, I think it's a great idea. You know, I saw one study on this that was pretty positive about using it, but that's about it. Not a lot of literature out there on the topic.
And then when you get the patient with anaphylaxis, you're going to do all of those things plus the epinephrine. And we did refer to that, you know, again, we don't have great evidence for epinephrine, but it's one of those critical care issues that we're not going to have great evidence for epinephrine, because who's going to volunteer to be in the randomized clinical control trial where you're in the placebo arm and you're sitting there going, and you're not going to be getting epinephrine, you're going to be getting the saline injection.
Yeah. So, you know, Ken, this is an example of sometimes clinical practice and clinical anecdote does trump the literature. We're never going to get that study. Like you said, it's never going to happen. But we've all seen this in front of us, that patients who come in with anaphylactic reactions that have airway issues, you give them epi and they get better. So we're going to keep doing that. So if they come in with anaphylaxis, they're hypotensive, they've got some wheezing, they've got some upper airway issues, maybe they're vomiting on top of that, I'm going to give them IM epi. I'm going to give them the other things, although I know they aren't going to work right away. But I'm going to give them that epi and I'm going to watch them, I don't know, a couple of hours, probably 2 hours. And when I say that I'm only going to watch them for 2 hours, I mean, if all of their symptoms have resolved and they're now symptom-free and stable, I'll watch them for 2 hours in the department. And if they don't have a recurrent or a biphasic response, I'm going to send them home with a couple of days of steroids, an H1 and H2 blocker, and most importantly, an EpiPen with instructions on how to use it. And I do like to do that education in the department of how to use one. And I also give them a link to YouTube where there's plenty of videos on how to use an EpiPen.
Nice. I think that's a great idea that we could especially refer some of our younger patients to YouTube and say, hey, here's a good YouTube video on actually how to do this as a using social media as an educational tool. Or in other words, the medium is the message. So what's your bottom line, Swami, from this case that we presented?
So bottom line to me is that prolonged observation is likely unnecessary in patients whose symptoms resolve with therapy in the emergency department. Biphasic reactions are really rare, and really they can occur anywhere from 10 minutes up to 6 days after the initial response.
So our case resolution, this medical student who was treated with epinephrine, an H1 and an H2 blocker, is observed for 3 hours. He's reassessed and doing well. He has no vomiting, hives, and his shortness of breath is gone. So he's discharged home with those EpiPens, as you discussed, oral steroids, and he's told to avoid his triggers. Is there anything else you want to add to that?
No, I think that's exactly what I would do, and that's a perfect case wrap-up.
So our Keener contest, last week we had a winner for the Beam Me Up episode, and that was Daniel McKay, and he knew that Dr. Chris Carpenter's H factor was 16. And the question this week is to name the top three categories which typically trigger anaphylaxis. Now, I'm going to give you one of them because I don't want everybody sending me in peanuts, shellfish, and eggs. Okay, that's food. That's one category. So if you know a couple of other categories that are the common triggers for anaphylaxis, send me an email, thesgem@gmail.com, with Keener Contest in the subject line, and you may receive a cool, skeptical stocking stuffer prize. This will be the last episode of the SGEM for 2013. I have one more special edition episode for next week, but it won't be reviewing a paper. It'll have a holiday surprise for everyone to say thanks to all the SGEM listeners. Swami, I want to thank you for taking some time in the busy month of December for closing out 2013 with me. And would you do the honor of giving the Skeptic's Guide tagline?
Absolutely. Remember to be skeptical of anything you learn, even if you heard it here on the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine.
Talk to everyone next week.